Hello, I'm Rich Kilgareth. Welcome to Bukomi. Now, as you know, the OMI in Bukomi stands for the original memorable insights that happen when we encounter books written by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
This is Dylan Jones, the author of Sweet Dreams, and this is my OMI for Bukomi.
We travel through time with the editor-in-chief of British GQ to a decade that waved away the glum, angry gloom of the 70s with a glamorous, techno-confident keyboard swagger, where the line outside a single London nightclub called The Blitz was more important than the line between rich, poor, gay, straight, trans, black or white.
It is a period that hasn't been excavated to death, like punk or heavy metal or soul or Britpop. It's something that hasn't really had a kind of laser look at it, and that's what I wanted to do.
In Sweet Dreams, the story of the New Romantics, Dylan Jones weaves an oral tapestry of voices that shape the look and sound of popular music between 1975 and 1985, from the dismal dereliction of John Lydon's Sex Pistols to peak shiny 80s with George Michael and Wham, coloured throughout by Margaret Thatcher's politics of self-improvement. It was a long moment in history that made us who we are today. Dylan, welcome to Bukomi.
Nice to see you.
As a journalist and an author, why was this period so important to you personally?
It's important because I think it's an often maligned period of British pop culture. And I think that it stands for many different things. I think that you can look at that period from sort of 79 to 84, 83, 84, and look upon it as such an extraordinary period for British pop music, and particularly the British pop single. And I don't think there's been a period probably since the mid-60s when the British pop single was so alive and so varied and so important and so culturally impactful. Also, in 1983, you had the second British invasion, where the majority of the American pop charts were made up of records by British artists, everyone from Culture Club to Wham to the Thompson Twins to the Eurythmics, everyone. Also, I think that the sort of electronic scene that came out of the Blitz and nightclubs in central London at the end of the 70s contributed to a really extraordinary period in pop culture. It was also a very bohemian period, and also, I think, a great period of emancipation for gay pop. So I think it has many things going for it. Plus, it is a period that hasn't been excavated to death, like punk or heavy metal or soul or Britpop. It's something that hasn't really had a kind of laser look at it, and that's what I wanted to do.
Reading the accounts of people who were there, actually there at the Screen on the Green in 1976 to see the Sex Pistols, who queued up outside Billy's, Blitz, the Beetroot, who got exploited by Malcolm McLaren, Love Bites off David Bowie, or blanked by Brian Ferry and Jerry Hall. It's like finding a bunch of diaries under a bed. Some of them, including Steve Strange, are no longer with us, though. How did you go about choosing what and who would be in the book? What voices were, you know, so influential and worth including in the history?
Well, I had a very strong idea of what the narrative arc should be, starting off in the soul clubs and the early punk clubs of the mid-70s and finishing with Live Aid. So I had a very strong idea of who should be in the book, and it was a mixture of clubbers who had been at those early clubs, a lot of those people who then went on to become pop stars, and it was a lot of the synth duos, and a lot of the people in media at the time. So I had a very, very clear idea, because this narrative hasn't actually been done before. I mean, you know the punk narrative, you know the post-punk narrative, the ska narrative, lots of different sort of genres have been described in quite infinite detail. But as I said, this is a very particular linear narrative. And because I had a very strong idea of what that narrative was, it made it quite easy to assemble the people in the book.
And one of the things that's revealing about it, which I'd never realised or made the connection, because I was very aware of the New Romantics or New Romanticism as a young teenager, but I didn't make the connection because I wasn't that sophisticated, it wasn't sophisticated at all, to David Bowie and Brian Ferry, and how those two figures influenced and drove really the move away from punk. And it was an obsession with them that inspired musicians and writers and designers to move on. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think that the influence of Bowie on several generations of pop stars is well known. But I think that the influence of Brian Ferry is often sort of forgotten about. But if you cast your mind back to the mid-70s, regardless of whether or not you were around at the time, and you look at the two most influential people in the sort of pop end of the creative arts, it was David Bowie and Brian Ferry. And Roxy Music were an extraordinary group, incredibly influential. And if you look at the early punks, and if you look at the early protagonists in the new romantic blitz scene, the nightclub scene, they were all aficionados of Bowie and Roxy. In fact, Billy's, which is the first proper club in this narrative, which was at Mead Street in Dean Street, the end of 1978. It was originally a Bowie night, and you'd go there and you would hear records predominantly by Bowie, by Roxy, by Iggy Pop, by Kraftwerk, but by lots of people who had been influenced by Bowie. So that through line to Bowie and Roxy Music is very, very important and very powerful.
You mentioned the other influences as well, and you create a really interesting set of ingredients, cultural influences and ingredients that make up the moment around 75, 76. Kraftwerk, for instance, and electronic music, disco via the gay scene with Donna Summer and I Feel Love, and of course, Brian Ferry and David Bowie. But who or what, because I was trying to pin this down, I was having this chat with my mate last night. We were talking about this and we were saying, what was the actual first new romantic band proper?
I think that you could look at this, and if it's very narrow, if you're taking a very narrow idea of what the new romantic scene is, it would probably be the Spandau Ballet record, to cut a long story short. But you had records by Ultravox, you had records by Visage, you had records by OMD beforehand. So all these sort of rivulets form this narrative. So you've got electronic pop, the number of synth duos that came out of the late 70s and early 80s, they're amazing, and they're all couples, they're all duos. There is OMD, there's Soft Cell, there's Blancmange, there's the Pet Shop Boys, only ever two of them. It's quite remarkable. And then you had the new romantic bands proper, who came out of the blitz scene, like Visage, like Culture Club, like Spandau. But then you had groups like Duran Duran, who came from Birmingham. Then you had people like Adamant, who sort of adopted the whole new romantic look, hook, line and sinker, where previously he'd been a very forthright punk. So that all of these different influences and all of these different records make up this weird kind of pattern.
Yeah, that was the song, to cut a long story short. That's the one that immediately springs to mind when we ever discuss, you know, what was the first new romantic song. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. And it was the tipping point from the kind of underground subculture to something that was mainstream. And it's that classic case of, my God, you know, people I know, friends of mine, are now on Top of the Pops. And that's a really strange sensation.
You set up Peter York and Robert Elms as polar opposites from a class point of view, writing about the same thing at the time. And as a magazine editor, do you miss the days when The Enemy and The Face would be rubbing shoulder pads with style writers from Harper's and Queen?
I don't miss the days. I don't, because although I think that it's a very important period, I'm not misty-eyed about it. I don't have nostalgia for it. What I wanted to do was catalogue it and present it in a way that it was perhaps hopefully taken more seriously than it had been. But certainly with the likes of Bob Elms and Peter York and other writers around at the time, you had people who were not only writing about the scene, but were also within the scene. And that always makes for an intoxicating mix. But I think if you're talking about politics, I think that a lot of the left-wing music press at the time tried to paint this sort of genre a very Thatcherite, quite shallow, rather trite, and full of people who were desperate for success at any costs. But actually, if you speak to almost everyone who was involved in that scene at the time, even though they were very entrepreneurial, they were all incredibly left-wing. It was very difficult to find anyone who espoused the principles of Margaret Thatcher, perhaps maybe Gary Newman and a few others, but most people were fairly left-wing or a sort of moderate ambivalence. And yet they're always cast in this really sort of keen Thatcherite way, which someone like Gary Kemp, for instance, took great exception to, because he was a card-carrying socialist at the time, as were most of Spandau.
And you really do uncover those differences and those gripes or those political inclinations. I love the anecdotes, especially about Gary Newman. And also Brian Ferry, and how I didn't understand until reading your book that difference, the way he sort of peeled off slightly, maybe because he was suddenly seen as the establishment. He was seen as a bit posh, wasn't he? A bit snooty. And he sort of got cast to one side, or he was elevated to the ranks of the establishment. How did class play its part in the New Romantic movement?
I think that you'd be hard pressed to find anyone involved at the time, like I say, who was particularly Thatcherite. But they were all very entrepreneurial. And I think that when you're talking about the difference between Bowie and Ferry, I think Bowie had an obsession with reinvention, and Ferry had an obsession with sort of sophistication. Ferry almost took one idea and just boiled it down and kept boiling it down and kept boiling it down to its sort of purest constituent parts, whereas Bowie was always far more interested in the happy accident and mixing things up and doing things for the hell of it. And I think that perhaps Brian Ferry's relentless sort of drive up market, his social climbing, became something which previously had been very attractive, but the reality, as you say, was tantamount to him joining the establishment, which I think turned a number of people off in the end, actually.
Talking of boiling things down, my first single that I bought on a trip to the local record shop by the co-op was Being Boiled by the Human League, because I had an older best friend who was much cooler than me, and he was into Adam and the Ants in this sort of Dirk Wears White Socks period, and I sort of tagged along. And I had no idea what was going on in Sheffield, Birmingham or London, but from that perspective, you could just sense, even as a kid, that it was something different. Punk, to me, was too scary. It was too violent. But this, running alongside things like The Clash and The Jam, which we're all aware of, seemed to grow with us into adolescence. And I think your book tracks that growth. The players in the story are still really part of the creative culture of today, aren't they? You know, that boat with the Jubilee boat with Sex Pistols, Malcolm McLaren, like Alan Yentob was on it. Richard Branson was on it. Where were you when that was happening? I know where I was, but where were you?
I was probably somewhere in High Wycombe, probably going to somewhere like the Nag's Head, which was the pub that we used to go to, which was run by a man called Ron Watts, who also used to run the 100 Club in London. And so anyone who would appear at the 100 Club would then appear at the Nag's Head in High Wycombe. So you saw a lot of pub rock groups there. You saw a lot of early sort of proto-punk groups there. So that's where I would have been. And I moved to London in August 1977, looking like a member of the Ramones, because I was obsessed with the Ramones, and went to art school, went to Chelsea art school for a year. And then in 1978, went to St. Martin's, which is where I met a lot of the people who became the early adopters, or not the adopters, but the protagonists of the Blitz scene.
You were right on the doorstep there, and you were witnessing it all firsthand, albeit from a slightly suburban entry point.
Yeah, I think that London at that time was full of people who had come to the city, not just from the suburbs, but from the outskirts of London, from different parts of the country. And I think that a lot of the excitement of the early punk days was very feverish. But I think a lot of people, including myself, became slightly disaffected with punk when it became quite orthodox, and quite quickly turned into something that was almost akin to sort of mob culture, which is why the music became so interesting, because post-punk incorporated a hell of a different number of different styles and genres, and included within that was the music that was associated with the club scene, and music which was perhaps associated with more of it, with more sort of a visual sheen to it. Because I think that what you can't forget is that a lot of this coincided with what happened in the 80s, when you had magazines and newspapers were starting to use colour a lot. You had the launch of the style press in the form of ID, The Face and Blitz, all of whom were full colour magazines who wanted to fill their pages with exotic creatures. You had the launch of MTV, where there was a real focus on the visual aspect of the band. So if you were visual, if you were colourful, if that was part of your appeal, then you got more traction than you would have done if you were one of the sort of shoegazer bands, those multitude of post-pop bands who all dressed in raincoats and stared at their shoes.
You quote the Human League's Phil Oakey, and he said of his own music, it has to be as easy to buy as a bar of chocolate, hence his lopsided hair look. And how much was New Romanticism about the look then, as you say, as well as the music? Because it was influenced, wasn't it, by fashion designers Vivian Westwood and her shop, creatives coming out of St. Martin's School like yourself. How much was the look important, and has it historically detracted from the musical talent of, say, Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran, Culture Club, Soft Cell, Ultravox, Depeche Mode, Sade, Wham, Adam and the Ants? Are we now preoccupied by the look of the 80s more than the music?
I think that at the time, people were very preoccupied with the way things looked. And critics of that period always talk about the decade of style and kind of style over content. They think of that period as being very shallow and again, being very sort of Thatcherite and very, very much about surface. And then you can look back to sort of 15 or 20 years ago, when there was real nostalgia fest in this country. Whenever people look back to the 80s, it was always looking at the sort of the rather more visual, the rather more trite aspects of the 80s. And as I said earlier, one of the reasons for doing this book is to try and rescue that period from that very sort of reductive criticism, which looks back at images of Adam and the Ants and just thinks that this is kind of contextualizes it as silly pop music and people dressing up. People did dress up, but they were pop singers. They were pop stars. But I think it is possible to go back to that period and look at the vast array of music. On the one hand, you have incredibly sophisticated modern soul from the likes of Sade. You have the originators of electronic pop with Kraftwerk. You had the brilliant sort of pop sheen of the likes of Duran Duran. There was so much going on.
You say of the period, the future kept arriving at that time in the form of videos, MTV, computer-generated music, keyboards. I remember the Casio Vialto, and everyone could be in a, you know, a synth band in their attic or their spare room, and the Moog synthesizer. But isn't that true of any time when you're young and the world is full of potential? Isn't the future arriving for everyone under 25 today? Do you see it as culturally significant then, this period, the New Romantic period, as, say, rock and roll in the 50s and 60s? And is the Blitz and Spandau Ballet as significant to us today as the Cavern Club and the Beatles, for instance?
I think that all periods have a cultural relevance. And I certainly wouldn't claim that this period has greater cultural relevance than the dawn of rock and roll or the swinging 60s or punk or glam or hip hop. But it certainly deserves to be treated in the same way. And it certainly deserves the same amount of attention that all of those different periods and all of those different genres have had.
And what happened to the kings and the queens of the clubs in the 80s? Where are they now?
Some of them have gone. Some of, you know, the likes of Steve Strange has slipped off this mortal coil. Some of them have been through rehab. Some of them are still going strong. And some of them have become permanent fixtures in the narrative arc of British pop music. All of those people are in this book.
I always love hearing about anything about Live Aid, and I loved your book, The 80s, which used Bob Geldof's iconic concert as a framework for that period. Was Live Aid the beginning of the end for the New Romantics?
I think that in some respects it was. I mean, I used it as a bullet point because I honestly think there is a narrative arc from 1975 to 1985. But also, I remember Live Aid. I remember being at Live Aid, being at Wembley that day. And you could tell that first half of the day was made up of the new stars, where you had Adamant, you had Spandau Ballet, you had Sade. You had lots of sort of relatively recent acts. And then towards the end of the day, you had these big sort of legacy acts, the likes of Queen and Elton John and U2 and David Bowie and all these people from the 70s. And in a way, you could see that there was a shift, that these legacy artists, most of them were probably only in their 30s, they were sort of reclaiming their ground. They were coming back to reclaim their crown in a way. And from that point onwards, stadium culture really took off and everybody wanted to play stadiums. And I remember in the late 70s, all the big American acts came to London and they wanted to play stadiums. With the likes of Bruce Springsteen, it wasn't that surprising because he'd already become a stadium artist. But Madonna wanted to play stadium. She played Wembley Stadium. Terrible concert. I saw Michael Jackson play Wembley Stadium. Terrible concert. Prince played, I think it was the Wembley Arena or the Empire Wembley Arena. Fantastic concert. He played in the round. But not everyone, not every big pop star from the 80s suited that kind of environment. I think pop sort of split into three different factions then. You had bands and artists who wanted to play stadiums. You had a lot of generic pop music driven by electronica, the likes of Stocktake and Waterman. And then you had the rise of acid house and hip hop, which turned into this sort of kaleidoscopic array of dance music, which has pretty much defined the pop music ever since.
Was it really a golden age, or will we, like Peter York, blame it for all the ills of today?
It certainly was a golden age, a complete golden age. I think you can look at most periods and think that if you isolate this little component, you could say that this is the cause of the downfall of Western civilization. Lots of strands come out of that period, but I think first and foremost, we need to look back at that period and realise what extraordinary music came out of it.
Dylan Jones, thanks for sharing your sweet dreams and your Omi with Bukomi today.
No, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Dylan's book, Sweet Dreams, The Story of the New Romantics, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bukomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bukomi pod, never miss an episode by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe and don't ever fade to grey. Bye for now. Thank you.